Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora.
Hey, hey, what's up? This is QLS Classic, April 4th, 2018, with the great Matthew Alfred Yankovic. That's right, y'all. Weird Al Yankovic joins us, and he talks about hilarious songs that Prince would never clear, why he turned down the opening slot on Michael Jackson's 1988 Bad Tour, and how he got away with poking fun at Kurt Cobain, Coolio, Iggy Azalea, and many more. Not to mention, I gotta say, this roll call intro is one for the record books. Hope you enjoy QLS with Weird Al Yankovic.
All right. Y'all ready?
Yep.
Damn, you yelling already, Lightyear? Let's go.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Rewind selector.
Rewind, yeah. I come back again, selector. Yeah, when the music is hot.
We are in the greatness of greatness right now,
we
ladies
are in
and
the
gentlemen.
Greatness of greatness.
Yes, we are in the greatness of greatness. We are we are remixing this roll call.
Uh-oh.
Thank you very much.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Matthew Yankovic.
Yes.
To all of y'all.
Yeah.
I just had the remix.
Yeah.
The brand new polka roll call.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema.
My name is Fonte.
Yeah.
This is my home.
Yeah.
Even Ezekiel thinks.
Yeah.
My mind is gone.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is Sugar.
Yeah.
I got the sugars.
Yeah.
I got sciatica.
Yeah.
And now I'm living with a hernia.
Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Of all the concerts,
yeah.
Boss Bill has been.
Yeah.
Weird Al Yankovic.
Yeah.
In the top 10.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
It's Laia.
Yeah.
Far from a virgin.
Yeah.
Weird Al is here.
Yeah.
Like a surgeon.
Call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
I don't freestyle.
Yeah.
I am the worst.
Yeah.
It would be better.
Yeah.
If this were rehearsed.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
That was fucking brilliant.
Steve was like, they gonna beat your ass for doing
that. Is that y'all playing?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, man. Like last minute, like 0 o'clock in the morning.
That was fucking brilliant.
Shout out to the Roots crew. Yes.
That's the first time we've done that, Al.
Yeah.
The first, wow. Yeah.
We've never changed the music up before.
First polka mashup.
Yes.
I'm impressed.
We had to. We're in the greatness of greatness. Ladies and gentlemen, what more can I say? We have one of the greatest. I mean, he shut down his own category. He is a one of one. There,
The job is taken.
What?
Yeah. Only one Weird Al.
No, it's just like, you know, you are the greatest parody satire writer.
Satirist?
Yes, satirist.
Satanist?
Yes, whatever. You are the GOAT.
Oh, thank you, man.
You are the GOAT.
You're the GOAT as well.
Thank you. I feel GOAT-ish. ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Alfred Matthew Yankovic.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
It's like a serial killer now.
I got to use a government name, bro.
Wow.
I have to use a government
name. And my social security number is 569.
Man, one, I'm grateful that you did this. I'm thankful because, you know, we've all been fans of yours, but I mean, it's to the point that you're not even a proper noun. I mean, you're a verb.
Like a Weird Al the song. Yeah. I Weird Al that song.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. How are you, though?
Well, thanks for asking. I'm doing very well. I just got back from Hawaii last night. We were there. We live there part-time, and I'm just kind of getting used to not seeing the ocean and flowers and beautiful things all the time.
What part
thanks
of
a
Hawaii?
Lot.
We live in the east side.
The east side, where he actually put his fingers on, like he's Tupac.
Hey, we live out in the jungle. We're about another half a mile down the road, and there's like no internet, no nothing. We're in the jungle, baby.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it's a whole different kind of Hawaii. I mean, you can go to the west side, and there's like, you know, you can have your drinks by the pool, and it's very resorty and very nice. But the east side is like old Hawaii, and it just feels like, you know, you can really kind of. It's a place where you go and do nothing. A lot of people like go to Hana and they go, oh, there's nothing here. Well, that's kind of the point. It's like a great place to unplug.
So you need it to sort of recharge and
yeah,
relax.
I mean,
and
yeah, it's kind of like the opposite of LA. So a couple times a year, my family goes out there and just kind of unplugs and, you know, talk to the cows, you know, hang out.
No, you just scared me with no internet.
Yeah.
It's like, get you away from Instagram.
Why would you ever want to do that? But I understand it's necessary. Where are you from?
From Linwood.
Straight out of Linwood.
Straight out of Linwood, yeah. In fact, Suge Knight went to my high school.
What?
Oh, wow.
Wait. Sarcasm detector is broken right now.
That's absolutely true.
Wow, okay.
Fred Gwynn from the Munsters, Mark Spitz, I believe, and Kevin Costner also went to the same time.
Wow.
I was at my finger on the trigger already.
Wow.
So, first of all, what were you like as a kid? And I ask that very slowly because I don't think people are accurate in describing themselves. But I mean,
well, this might come as a huge shock to you, but I was a little nerdy.
Really?
It was just,
no.
No, I was definitely, well, I was sort of a, you know, sort of a weird kid. I was, but I was always a good student. I was always a straight A student, the kind of guy that you try to copy off of during math class and then beat up at recess, you know.
Because you gave them the wrong answers anyway. No. Just to throw
just mess with them. But no, I was always a good kid. But I was always a little strange. I kind of kept to myself and ate with the other nerdy kids during lunchtime. That kind of thing.
Okay. Basically,
you can relate
in my
there,
life.
Yeah.
All of us. Yeah. All of us in this room had that backstory. So you're gift of music, how did that start? Like,
well, I guess it started when my parents decided I should take accordion lessons.
Why?
Well,
they put a kick me sign on you.
I think the joke answer is that they realized that accordion music was going to take over Western civilization. but really, I think they honestly thought that it would make me more popular because, you know, when you play the accordion, you're a one man band. You're the life of any party.
Don't you need a little?
Yeah.
You know something, Mel? They were right.
In their own weird way.
I mean, there's no one in this world that does not know who you are. So it's like,
it was actually kind of a stroke of luck that they decided on such a dorky instrument because Dr. Demento, the disc jockey who really started my career, he says that, you know, when he got my first tape in the mail, he said if it was some teenage kid playing the guitar and doing those same songs, he wouldn't have given it a second thought. But because there was this teenage kid playing the accordion and somehow thinking he was cool, he said, well, that's a novelty. That's worth some airtime.
Wow. So can you break down for us how the accordion works, like as an instrument? Like how, like
physically
how
do you read works?
Yeah, how it physically works and how you read the music. Does it, is it like a piano or?
The right hand part is like a piano. It's like, okay. We're talking about piano accordions. They're different kind of accordions, but that's the one I use. So the right hand part is exactly like a piano. And the left hand part is buttons. There are accordions have different numbers of buttons. 120 is like the standard one.
Okay.
The top two rows are basses. And all the rest are chords. Like the next row of chords is major chords, then minor chords, then seventh chords, and then diminished chords. Mm. And there's a lot of repeat buttons because you don't want to have to like do one button on one side of the accordion, then immediately go to the other side. So you just, it's just, you know, looking back on it, it's kind of a hard instrument to learn.
And yeah, it sounds really complicated.
I figured that out because I gave my daughter accordion lessons. Like a few years ago, she out of the blue decided she wanted to play the accordion, which, you know, I have to say that so they don't send her to Child Protective Services. She actually asked for accordion lessons. And we got her a little accordion and I taught her some Christmas songs and she lost interest after a couple of months, but she actually, you know, can play a few songs.
That's what's up.
Is there a left-handed accordion for those whose lead hand is their left?
Oh, you mean to play like the keys on the left hand?
Yeah.
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know. I mean, maybe you could play it upside down. I've never seen that done, though. I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't know.
Are you related to... Now, there was a clip when you first came to the Tonight Show to sit in with us, and we did this extended polka jam, and it was based on a Yankovic who was...
Yankovic, yeah.
Are you related to him
at all? Not as far as I can figure. I mean, I may be several generations ago. I'm sure we're all related Yankovic, somehow,
right.
but no direct relation. But that might have been another reason why my parents decided I should take accordion lessons, because there was already America's Polka King, Frankie Yankovic, and they thought, oh, there should be at least one more accordion-playing Yankovic in the world. I Frankie passed away some time ago, but I actually got to bring him out to L.A., and feature him in a TV special called Weird Al's Guide to the Grammys, because polka was a category for the first time that year, sometime in the late 80s, I guess. And we did a whole thing where we, you know, gave him a fake star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and we did a poolside interview. We did a whole Frankie Goes to Hollywood segment.
So growing up, or at least being a teenager in the 70s and on the dawning of disco, how are you able to have a high school existence, sort of like, you know, with band practice and that sort of thing with the accordion? Like, were you starting bands and those things?
I tried. And for some reason, none of my friends that had bands felt the need for an accordion player. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I found out early on that if I really wanted to play the accordion, I could either, you know, play for bar mitzvahs and Italian weddings, or I could go my own way. And I was always drawn toward the bizarre and comedy. And when I was exposed to Dr. Demento, that really kind of opened the door for me, because I thought, oh, well, these are my people.
I see. So I want to know, like, right before Dr. Demento, like, could you play any other instrument or?
Not really. I mean, you know, when you play the accordion, that means you can also play the piano, of course. Mm-hmm. But so technically I could, but my right hand is very used to keys and my left hand is not. So to this day, if I'm playing piano, I'm, you know, my left hand is just either I'm playing some very rudimentary lines or I'm waving to the crowd.
That is weird. Okay. So explain the Dr. Demento connection in 76 with you giving him.
When I actually gave him a tape, Dr. Demento came to my high school, oddly enough, and was doing an assembly. Sometimes he puts on a show where he does, you know, does an educational assembly of comedy and demented music. And he happened to be at Lynwood High School. And at the same time, he was doing a contest called a contest for Pico and Sepulveda, which is his theme song. And people were sending in their own versions of the Pico and Sepulveda, Pico and Sepulveda, Pico and Sepulveda. And I did my own horrible version of it and gave him the cassette tape in person. And I think he promptly lost it. it was terrible, and I never made it to air. But that was my first contact with him. And since then, I would send him stuff in the mail. And eventually, it got good enough that he started playing them on the radio. But when I first started, I was like 13 years old. I mean, even the stuff he played was horrible, but before that, they were extra horrible.
Were these originals, or did you even start the world of parody then? Like, Making fun of Leo Sayer and Stevie Wonder and that sort of thing?
It was a little bit of both. I mean, Pico and Sepulveda would have been a cover. But yeah, the first songs I sent him, it was a combination of originals and parodies, but none of it had much of a rock feel to it because, you know, I was used to my classical training on the accordion was polkas and some classical pieces. So I really kind of got into playing rock on the accordion by just playing along with my Elton John records and things like that, just trying to figure out like rock chord structures.
Okay, so the first time I've heard of you was, I think, Another One Rides the Bus, and I think it was like 81, like someone...
Wait, it was the actual date that we did that was September 14th, 1980.
Okay.
Which was, it was a live performance because we never re-recorded that. I just played it live on the Dr. Domeno show and he happened...
Oh, that was it?
It was live on the show and he just happened to turn the tape recorder on for an air check. And that air check of that live recording, that is the master tape to this day.
Oh, wow. Wow.
You still have that tape?
The original tape, I would assume Dr. Domeno has it, but I mean, it sounds just like, you know, what's on the record.
Oh, okay. Is he still, Dr. Domeno is still alive?
He is, yeah. He's not on terrestrial radio anymore, but he is still doing a weekly show at drdomeno.com. So he's still doing it. Same show.
Wow. Okay, so your initial rhythm section kind of had this fart noisy thing that I used to always be obsessed with.
Yeah.
Like that start, you know, every kid has an obsession with farting.
Uh huh.
But it was when I heard Another One Rides the Bus, then I started like trying to do fart.
Right.
First of all, who's making that noise? And then
That is musical Mike Kiefer. Mike Kiefer has been part of the Dr. Menno show for many years. And he is, the technical term is manualist, a person that makes those flatulent noises with his hands. I used him a lot for the first few albums, not so much in later albums. But it was quite a process because he would have to it was a whole process to record that in the studio. First, he'd have to wash his hands very thoroughly because they couldn't be at all greasy. They had to be super squeaky, clean, dry. And then we used two microphones because when he puts his hands together, one noise would come out of the top of the hands and one noise would come out of the bottom of the hands, so we get real actual stereo separation.
You guys are real scientists. Wow. About this. Right. Shit.
Yeah, yeah.
No, don't do this.
Yeah.
How do you figure out you right have now. This
talent? So how did you, well, I know that was My Balloon on the B-side, I'm not certain, but how did you get to the next level from just like making this stuff for Dr. Demento and then like there's labels out there, yeah, that want to...
My Balloon was the year before. That was recorded literally in a bathroom. And then Another One Rides the Bus. And that was still while I was in college. I was getting my degree in architecture at the time.
What college? What school?
The California Polytechnic State University at San Luis Obispo.
Ah,
okay. And after I graduated, basically I knew that I didn't want to be an architect. I wasn't sure that I'd ever be able to make a career in the music industry because you have a hit on the Dr. Domeno show, that doesn't really mean anything in the real world. But I decided, well, you know, I'm young and I've got some time and let me knock on a few doors. And luckily, within a couple of years, I was able to land a record deal. So based on the early recordings and some new demos that I'd done, I did I Love Rocky Road for I Love Rock and Roll. And based on that, we were able to land Rick Derringer as a producer and a Scotty Brothers as a record label. And we did the first album. Did okay. It didn't burn up the charts, but it did fine. It did well enough to merit me doing a second album. And the second album had...
That's when everything changed.
Yeah, yeah. That's when it happened with Eat It. Yeah,
yeah. But even then, what was the selling point that, you know, like, is this... Were you trying to say, look, as a comedian, were you trying to be billed as a comedian or... You know, well, satirist or just...
I wasn't so much into labels, but you know, I was going for grins. It was obviously a comedy act. It was meant to be novelty, and that was a reason why it was hard for me to get signed to a record deal, because we approached basically every record store in record company in town, and record stores too, but a record company in town, and they all said, oh, this is really funny stuff, this is brilliant work, yeah, we're not interested, this is novelty, you're going to be like, you know, if you're lucky you'll be a footnote and you'll be gone in 6 months. So we want artists that are going to have a lasting career.
Words.
Yeah.
So with N3D, did you think like, okay, this is going to be my one and only album? And
Well, I mean, it was sort of you never know, because when I was signed, I was signed to a 10-album deal, and that doesn't mean, oh, I'm going to do 10 albums. That means on the extremely off chance that I'm successful enough to have 10 albums,
they'll be on this label.
Yeah.
But they can drop you anytime.
Right. So you never know. And my first album, like I said, it did okay, but not great. And you know, every album could have been my last. So you always have that in mind. But after Eat It came out. After N3D came out and it did so well, I was pretty sure there was going to be another album after that.
Can you explain to us just, I guess, the legal way that you're able to do the parody? What's the line between parody and, you know, lawsuit. Copyright infringement? Yeah, lawsuit. Yeah. Like, how do you navigate that?
I always try to go a little above and beyond because, according to Supreme Court rulings, fair use would imply that I could get away with a lot more than I do. You know, in terms of parody and satire, I don't necessarily have to ask permission, but I always do, because part of my logic is that I want to have long-term relationships with all the artists that I'm parodying. And I really honestly want them to feel like they're in on the joke. I don't want anybody to be upset or offended that I'm doing a parody of one of their songs. It's all meant in good fun. And I want them, you know, I don't want to step on anybody's toes.
So then with the parody works that you make, how is the publishing split between, is it you or is it all the old artists?
I'll tell you, it's literally a different case every time. Every single one is negotiated. I would say, by and large, the standard deal is the original artist keeps all the publishing.
Yikes!
You get the writer.
We split the writers.
Okay, yeah, gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to get some of the publishing, but people are very loath to give that up.
Gotcha.
Well, damn, we already rushed to your no's versus your yeses, and I guess your most famous no was Prince. But
yeah,
first of all, I want to know, what song did you try to parody of Prince? And then what's the asking process?
There were about a half a dozen songs that I approached Prince for. One of them was going to be in my movie UHF, which was Let's Go Crazy, but with the lyrics of the Beverly Hillbillies theme song.
The
man named Jay. Man, kept his family fit.
Oh, wow.
Would have been fun. There, 1999, I wanted to do that about like a Mr. Ron Popeil kind of like ad for like, you can buy this for $19.99. You know?
That would have been brilliant.
And there were like a half a dozen like that I wanted to try, but.
You know you can now.
Well,
right?
You said.
Well, no.
Oh, they welcome it now.
No. Prince isn't going to change his mind now. That's the thing. You know, and I respect the artist's wishes, you know.
So like that, you're one of the people that, like, clear. Even if his,
it doesn't matter what the state,
like,
says, no. I mean, you know,
you would know that he would reject
it's
you.
Not their wishes. I'm concerned about his Prince's wishes, and you know,
that's awful. That's nice.
Good, man. Yeah. Good man.
But dog, all right. Did you at least demo it? Yes, you demoed it. Do you have the demo?
There's no need to do a demo for a parody because you know how it goes,
right?
Right? I mean,
you didn't do a full scale 1999.
I did not. You know, for a lot of songs, I don't even write any lyrics until I get permission, because it's really a bummer to go through. Yeah, because I spend sometimes like weeks on a single song, and to go through all that effort and then to go, yeah, I don't really like parodies. You know, that's a heartbreak.
So how far did you get to the point of asking, can I do a parody, or asking, can I do a parody of, and this is what
no,
I'm
we always we always pitch a specific idea. So we always say, we want to do a parody of this song, and here's the general idea.
I don't know where I heard from. I think someone had asked him a question about it, and he said something like, actually, I like him or whatever, but it wasn't an eye roll or like a, no, my songs can never, but.
The only thing I've heard audio of him talking about my fat video.
Yeah, I was going to ask
that. Maybe he said something else, but that's the thing I've heard. And he liked that at the time, so that's nice.
Oh, what did he say?
It's a rehearsal tape, and he's basically asking the band if they saw the video for Fat, and he's like just talking about him in the fat suit, and he's just like cracking up the entire time he's telling the story. It's pretty great.
That would have been encouraging.
Yeah.
That would have been, damn, man, now you would have killed 1999. Can you think of the other Prince songs that you tried?
What else? Those were my favorites. I think there was something with When Doves Cry. Like, I think of like a fast food guy, When Spuds Fry, or something like that. Another food song.
How do ideas come to you? Like, do you have these dictaphones on standby, or, you know, like, just when moments, like,
Well, in the very beginning, it was just like whatever stupid idea came to my head, I go, oh, I'll go with that. But after I started getting some success and realizing people actually, you know, care about what I do and a lot of people will obsess over it, I think, well, I should put some more effort into this. So now whenever I find a song that I think has potential for parody, I'll think of like 100 ideas for it. I'll think of like every variation on the theme I possibly can. I'm very analytical about it. I'll go down a list and try to see which of those ideas have any comedic potential and would be able to sustain comedy for 3 to 3.5 minutes. And sometimes none of them do. I mean, sometimes they're all bad ideas, but if I'm lucky, one will stand out.
So are you obsessively reading Billboard and listening to music and
I certainly used to. I haven't been that obsessive in the last couple of years. I'm kind of slowing down a little bit. I'm looking at other projects, but in the thick of it, when I'm actively trying to figure out what are the parodies, yeah, I'm listening to a top 40 radio and definitely studying Billboard.
Well, I was gonna say, like, you know, there's always, as a musician and as a music fan, there's a point in your life where you're actually engaged in contemporary music culture, and then there's a point where you're like, you feel like I hate music now. Or not I hate music, yeah. But it's,
well, I'll tell you, you know, I like top 40 music, I like that, but you know, it's not my first choice. I mean, if I could listen to any radio station, I wouldn't automatically listen to the top 20 hits, you know.
Right.
So whenever I was, it wasn't that I was not enjoying it, but I kind of felt like I was on the clock. You know, I was working.
Yeah, I was going to say, does it make it harder for you now? Like, if you hear something as insanely popular as Bad and Bougie,
yeah,
or Bodak Yellow,
uh-huh,
and you're like, okay, I know this can be an instant viral moment for me, but am I really emotionally invested to...
That would be interesting, though, Bodak. That would be an interesting Weird Al parody.
Yeah. Well, I'll consider all that.
They both would be.
Wait, hey, what'd you say?
I said they both would be.
Oh, I thought you said they both are parodies.
Well, I mean, that too.
What's your actual favorite type of music, like when you're just at home?
Mostly like Viking songs and whaling music.
Great.
You know,
thank you.
Like 13th century stuff.
Wow. So like Game of Thrones? So,
no, that's too contemporary. Yeah.
That stuff's still better than pop music today. Mm-hmm. So
that's when music was good.
Yeah. Yeah, like I don't particularly engage in the music that I make a living in, but you know, I mean, if I'm driving in a car, I'd rather listen to jazz and something completely opposite, or at least to get inspired. So
I find I listen a lot to the music that I was listening to in high school and college. That's sort of like my comfort food of music. It's sort of like, oh,
well, that's what I'm asking you. What kind of stuff is that?
You know, it's a lot of British Invasion stuff, a lot of singer-songwriter stuff from the 70s, like a lot of, you know, the kind of the garage bands from the 90s kind of thing, the grunge movement, a lot of artists that are not necessarily comedy or novelty, but have a sense of humor and, you know, alternative stuff.
And what about your record collection? You still have your record collection from... when you were a teenager,
you know,
and all that?
You know, I should have held on to all my vinyls. My wife talked me into
getting
rid of those. You know, we got the CD, like, yeah, but it's but I want to stay married, so.
Damn.
Yeah, they take up space.
No,
yeah,
they do.
I know.
The women. The wife.
I knew that was coming.
Sorry. So on the, I guess, the opposite side of the fence. Oh, wait, before I get to Michael Jackson, how important is it to you to sort of nurture relationships? Because I find that oftentimes if you go the traditional business route,
yeah,
okay, I'm going to do something on Rod Stewart.
Yeah.
And then your manager calls their manager. The label calls their label. Then usually it's like some red tape shit and it never happens. But, you know, if you happen to be friends with Rod Stewart and you're like, look, I have a really cool idea. Oh, yeah, I'll be honored for you to, you know, that sort of thing.
That happens a lot, you know, because sometimes it's just hard to get through to another artist. So if I ever have a direct connection, and I've used that several times. I mean, I did that with Kurt Cobain. Like, you know, my manager couldn't get through to his, you know, their manager. And finally, you know, I knew somebody at Saturday Night Live and they were performing that day. And I said, could you please get Kurt on the phone? And I got to talk to him directly.
That easy?
Well, basically. And then I told my manager and I said, Kurt's fine with it. And then his manager could call back their manager say, Kurt's fine with it.
How did you pitch Kurt Cobain?
Well, this is a famous story. I talked to him on the phone, and this was their first time on Saturday Night Live. I'm not sure if he was in his right mind, but right. I was talking on the phone, and I said, "Hey, Curtis, so Weird Al Yankovic, and I wanted to do a parody of your song, Smells Like Teen Spirit." And he goes, "Oh, that's cool." And then there's a kind of a pause, and he goes, "Is it going to be about food?"
He's a fan.
Yeah, yeah. And I said, "Well, no, that's actually about how nobody can understand your lyrics." And he goes, "Oh, hey, sure, that's funny."
No.
That was it.
Wow.
He was a very cool guy. He actually wrote some very nice things about me in his journals. Remember when they published the Kurt Cobain journals?
Yeah.
He wrote a, well, humble brag here, but he wrote Weird Al Yankovic is a modern rock genius in his journal.
You are. I mean, no, dog, you are. So, you doing Eat It at the height of Michael Mania, I would think that it was actually easier to get permission from Prince at that time period than Michael Jackson. Michael's like one of your most accommodating.
That was a real shot in the dark because, you know, at that time, I certainly wasn't any, you know, kind of household name. I was just this weird kid from L.A. that was making these stupid records. And we thought, oh, maybe Michael Jackson will sign off on this. Like, ha, ha, ha. But our mantra was, you know, it never hurts to ask. You know, what's going to do? Say no. So we put it out there, and I forget how long it took. But
was it a face-to-face thing? Or
No. I got to meet Michael after the fact a couple times. But at the time, it was just sort of like, okay, Michael signed off on it, and there is a contract. I've got a copy of it with my signature next to Michael Jackson's signature saying that we are the co-writers of Eat It.
Wow.
That is cool.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, was one of the first records I ever owned.
Oh,
Eat
cool.
It.
Yeah. Wow.
So Scotty Brothers, were they seeing dollar signs as in, like, let's do the video full scale, or, you know, how did you convince them to?
Well, they had Eye of the Tiger money by this point, did they not?
Survivor, yeah. So they had that.
Wait, didn't you do, I think you did Rye the Kaiser?
I did that on the second album as well, yeah.
Yeah.
They're happy about that, yeah. I think that was probably the same studio the original was recorded in, so that was nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they also had James Brown.
Yeah, they had it was the Unreal album. Wasn't that on Scotty
Brothers? Well, they had Gravity.
Gravity.
Living with a hernia.
Yeah.
Living with a hernia.
Yeah. Got to support those Scotty Brothers artists, you know.
Well, Dan Hartman was happy. I know that much.
Yeah, yeah.
So, what was the brainchild kind of genesis of the Eat It video to go full scale on it?
Well, that was in the days when people were obsessed with MTV, where, you know, if a video was on heavy rotation, like Michael Jackson obviously was, you knew every minute detail of the video. And it was very easy to parody because all you had to do was recreate it and just tweak things just a little bit and it would be funny. And at the time, it was my most, expensive video because my first video cost like $3,000. My record label was like, oh, great, we'll do all your videos for $3,000. Like, no, hold on. I think Eat It at the time, my manager hates when I talk money, but I'll tell you, it cost $40,000.
Ooh, that was real video money.
That was at the time. But I mean, that was the best $40,000 I ever spent in my life.
But how did you find the jacket, and how'd you get Sheryl Song to be in the video?
You could buy the jacket in any store at the time. It was 1984, man. It was like the Michael Jackson.
Even the piano tee you had on and all that. That was
the piano tee. We had to have a art director cook up for us. The jacket was just off the rack. Like if you want to, pay whatever it was, $600 to get a leather Michael Jackson jacket, that could be had.
Who directed who directed the video?
I do. That was my manager, Jay Levy.
Jay is everywhere.
Yeah, he was making his directorial debut. I mean, I storyboarded it out and figured out the shots, and then I said, here, Jay, you deal with this.
I was impressed that you had Sheryl Song in the video, the long-haired Asian woman from Soul Train.
Oh, yeah.
Who,
my her, idol.
Her hair head comes off or whatever. Wait, was Michael
that
Peterson
wasn't her actual head, no.
No. No, I was trying to figure if you got Michael Peters.
We
or...
did, yeah. Is that his name? Or, no,
Michael Peters was the
choreographer.
One of the choreographers was in, I'm going to blank on his name. It sounds like Peterson.
Well, he was the original White Jacket.
He was the original guy.
Yeah.
Was that Michael?
Michael Peters.
Michael Peters was the White Jacket guy.
Okay. Yeah.
That's him.
That was him.
How?
We asked him. He said, okay.
Damn. So how much does the original Beat It video cost, y'all think?
I know Billie Jean was 65. It was still under 100,000.
Okay. Was it really? Wow.
Yeah. It was under, yeah. I mean, Thriller was a million, but I know Billie Jean was 65 and Beat It was like 85.
Wow. So you did about half the price.
Under, yeah, like slightly under 100.
Yeah, we had to recreate the barroom scene and a few other things. We looked for the original locations, but it was all, they all had
Was that the pool hall?
The pool hall, yeah. That was just a set on stage.
Oh, wow.
Man, congrats on the details, man.
Oh, thanks.
Actually, my favorite thing about your repertoire is your polka medleys. And I'll say that the first time that I saw you not on Solid Gold or MTV, the Tonight Show. I don't know if you did Hokuto and Polka.
Yeah, like in 85.
Dog, that was the most jaw-dropping. That's when I started buying your albums. Like back then, you were just a weird out guy and like, oh, the Edie guy, whatever, you know. But when I saw that,
that was fun. I remember that we had to have the actual Tonight Show band playing the horn section behind us. They had to learn all the charts.
Yeah, so that's the thing. Like, you're not just a parody guy. Like, you're these arrangements and the clever nuances of like how you do "Owner of a Lonely Heart" with the clarinet arrangements, right? And stuff. Are you notating this stuff on scoring it? Or
oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, now I use notation software, but at the back then in the day, I just would print out, or I wouldn't even print out. I'd use the staffs and just write it with pencil right on there.
Okay, you can help me and Steve out on this because I'm so okay. When you do the bang your head,
yeah.
Ding, 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 ding.
Right.
Okay, what is the horn honk? That's what is that called? We were looking for it for at least a half hour. It's a
that's called a bulb horn.
So it has the rubber
yeah, that's
thing.
Yeah, that's the rubber thing you squeeze it.
I was going through every like every
that's
type
a bicycle
of
horn. Come right. On, man.
I couldn't Google, like I was oh god. I was looking for her
right
for the longest. And
but that sounds pretty good. I mean, you just,
yeah, that was really sounds like a bulb horn.
Sample that.
That actually sounded, and they're small. There's different size ones too.
Yeah,
obviously
you want the big one
too.
Though. Really,
yeah, the big one's the funniest one. Yeah.
No, because I was going to go full scale with the theme and do the sound effects, but I wasted almost a half hour. It was 4 a.m. Yeah. I was like going through every horn.
You could have called me, man.
Hindsight, you know.
I have a question before you move on. You're moving on from Eat It.
No, go ahead.
So on Eat It, even though it was a parody song, it seemed like you were taking the acting and the choreography and everything real seriously. And I was wondering how long it took you to put on all that weight.
Oh, you
to do that to do the part.
You're thinking of fat now. That was a different
fat.
Video.
Yeah.
Oh, different shit. Video. Fat and Eat It.
That was a fat suit.
I'll get back to when we're talking about fat.
Yes. All right. Let's go to Derby's.
I was trying to make a joke that you actually gained the weight, but shit.
I had a few salads and I, you know.
Hit the bullhorn.
No, I'm not hitting the bullhorn, but I am hitting.
Words of wisdom. Just got some from Sugar Steve.
No, that's supposed to be when I say something actually.
No, that's when you say anything. Okay. Was Dare to Be Stupid your first national tour?
I think that there we did a national tour in 84, which is kind of funny because my first tour was 83. It was a very small tour. And I think in 84, I went out with Dr. Demento as his opening act.
Oh, wow.
And it started with like Dr. Demento featuring Weird Al Yankovic. And the tour started before Eat It came out. Mm-hmm. And we're on the road, and Eat It comes out, and it zooms in the top 20. And in the middle of the tour, the tour became Weird Al Yankovic with Dr. Demento.
Wait, was this show syndicated?
It was, yeah, it was nationally syndicated, yeah.
Really?
He did a live show at KMET in Los Angeles, and then he did a separate show syndicated out of Westwood One, which went to, I forget how many markets, but all over the country.
Okay. So was there, I mean, after, just talk about the pressure of life after Eat It, where you became known as the Eat It guy.
Right.
How did life change? I think I saw raw footage of you even at the Purple Rain premiere.
Right.
was that a star moment for you? It's like Eddie Murphy came in, then Morris Day, then Weird Al Yankovic. And you have this whole, like, I'm just happy to be here, yeah, like, type of thing.
Yeah, I think it said, yeah, everybody knew Prince could act, but who knew he could sing?
So how different was life after, because you captured lightning in a bottle. Like, even, you know, your video made Soul Train.
Oh, yeah.
That was my favorite introduction. Don Cornelius is like, and now this is the closest that we will ever get to Michael Jackson. This is Weird Al Yankovic and Eat It.
Oh, man.
I was like, wow, Weird Al is on Soul Train. That's amazing.
Well, I mean, the biggest change was that it was really, in the truest sense of the word, overnight fame. I mean, you hear about overnight things like that, and it really was overnight. I mean, the day that Eat It went into heavy rotation on MTV, which is several times a day, you know, people were recognizing me on the streets. I'd be in line at a fast food restaurant, and people would be staring at me like, this is odd. This has not happened before. Mm-hmm. And yeah, all of a sudden I was the Eat It guy, and that it just changed in an instant.
Would you look like Weird Al Yankovic even off duty? Like, were you always in Hawaiian shirts?
Yeah, I've always liked Hawaiian shirts, but certainly, after I gained some notoriety, I kind of dressed down a bit more in public. I try not to be too loud or garish.
Started wearing hats and sunglasses.
I never, you know, went into the big disguises, because then people are like, oh, what's Weird Al doing wearing like a hat and dark glasses?
Wow. So how hard was it adjusting to a follow-up record? Like, is there such a thing as writer's block for, you know, for doing parody records? Or,
oh yeah, I mean, you know, every album I start out with writer's block, because like, oh, what am I gonna do now? Like, because, like, you know, you don't want to keep repeating yourself, and you know, you want to still be funny, and but you don't want to, like, kind of rely on the same tropes and memes and devices that you used before. You want to try to find different ways to be funny. And
but how is it that you don't want to be pigeonholed as the comedian parody guy when you're the comedian parody guy?
Well, I'm not saying I didn't want to be the comedian parody guy. I mean, I knew that parodies were my bread and butter, and I enjoyed doing them, and I wasn't trying to get away from that. I just didn't want to, like, you know, it kind of horrified me when my record label put out a compilation called The Food Album. Here's all Al's songs about food. Like, maybe I shouldn't write so many songs about food. You know?
Well, I was going to say, were they coming to you like, okay, like, you know, do more, you know, food songs?
Well, no, they were basically, you know, the thing about Scotty Brothers, they were wonderful to me, but every fourth quarter they'd go, you know, we could really use some money for our bottom line. We're going to put out a compilation album. Like, really? Another one?
You know,
like, here's all of Al's songs that begin with the letter R. You're like, no, don't do that. Don't do that.
Already so soon? It was like two records in. You already have the greatest hits.
But I'll tell you, after two records, speed. I don't think they weren't talking about a greatest hits after two records, but they were saying, like, how about a Christmas album? Like, really? I don't think so, no. You know, they're looking for any way to quickly cash in, because they didn't know that, you know, I'd still be around, you know? You know, 30 years later, they were thinking, like, okay, you know, here's our cash cow, let's milk it.
Right. So on the opposite side of the fence, were there artists now giving you elevator pitches on how to turn their songs into Weird Al songs by this point?
I won't mention any names. It hasn't happened.
Please.
No.
I don't mean salacious, but...
Well, I've had people, more often than giving me pitch, they would say, like, when are you going to get around to doing one of my songs?
Mm. Wow.
And this is almost like a sign, like, you made it when Weird Al.
Yeah, if he covers your stuff, like, yeah, you've officially arrived.
Yeah. I think when I met Paul McCartney for the first time, he offhandedly said that. I think he was kind of joking, but still, it kind of blew my mind.
Did he tell you the scrambled egg story?
No, but I know that one.
Oh, okay. I was the first original Weird Al.
For Yesterday, yeah, that was his original lyrics, right?
Yeah, scrambled eggs.
Oh, my baby, how I love your legs, or whatever it was.
So I know that the Dare to be Stupid tour for anyone that I know that's into you, that was, I really truly wish I'd seen this tour.
That's the one Jimmy Fallon's always talking about.
That was Jimmy's first concert,
Yeah. But no, I know like 10 other people that are like, yo, the Dare to Be Stupid tour. Like, what exactly happened during this tour that just changed these people's lives?
I'm not sure. I mean, every tour got bigger and better. Up until then, I kind of felt kind of green, and I think it kind of all clicked into place on Dare to Be Stupid, because I've seen some YouTube videos of me in concert in 1984 versus 1985, and there's definitely something that happened to my confidence between those 2 years, because 84, I just seemed a little manic and desperate, and in 85, I kind of, you know, feel like, okay, I know what I'm doing. Here I go. So there's probably something to that. The performances just felt a little bit more, you know, on point.
Okay, I want to go to Polka Party and break down your harmony game on Here's Johnny.
Oh, wow. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
No, it's some serious shit. Like, you... I know you think that, like, oh, these small, minuscule things are, like, over people's heads or whatever. No, but it's really art to it. Like,
I'm all about the minuscule things.
How? But you're self-produced, correct?
Yeah, I am now. The first six albums were Rick Derringer, so he was officially producing at that time.
Okay. Do you... I mean, what was the give and go relationship on that? Was he just like, do what you do, Al, and I'll just...
Well, he wasn't that laissez-faire.
Am I the guy in the studio that's like pointing you in the movies, like, you know, that sort of thing?
Yeah, or... I mean, he was in charge of the sound. I was walking in with all the arrangements and things like that, and you know, Rick wasn't saying we should have clarinets here. It was sort of like, you know, that was my gig, and he would just make sure that he was sort of like the director. He made sure that everything that I did sounded as good as possible in the studio.
And matching, like, for matching the patches and stuff, like, is that you? Or are you...
Same synthesizers and all that.
Yeah, are you actively going after these, like, same keyboards and the same drums and those sort of things? And
within reason, yeah. I mean, you know, oftentimes if we have access to the original band or the original band members, we'll contact them and say, well, yeah, what were the pickups on that guitar? What did you use for this particular thing? Sometimes, especially if it's an odd sample, we'll try to figure out where that came from and see if we can license that as well. So that's not all the time. Sometimes we just wing it, but whenever we can, we like to be as official as possible.
Have you ever, not blacked out, but had a great idea that you just couldn't make funny? Either, you know, like you had a great title for Lionel Richie's All Night Long, but you couldn't...
I'm a pretty good judge of knowing if an idea has potential. So if it might be, some ideas might be funny for like a throwaway gag, but they won't be, you know, funny for 3 minutes.
A full song, yeah.
So that and sometimes in concert, I would do a medley of those kind of songs where like there's basically just one gag to it. Like, oh, here she comes. She's a spam eater. Thank you. Good night. You know, and that's sort of like there's really not a whole lot more to say after that. So all the ones that I wind up making into parodies, I think, okay, well, I can build on this. I can put layers to this, and there's a direction to go. It's not just like a one joke thing.
How many were these the Grammys that you won? Were they for comedy recordings or for polka or?
They were comedy. They were different ones though. The first one was for comedy recording, and that was an odd category because it was singles competing against albums, which it seems like apple and oranges to me, but that's how they did it back then.
Wait, how? Really?
Yeah, because the Eat It single, and it won against like Rodney Dangerfield's album and Eddie Murphy's album. Like, how do you really
you beat Eddie Murphy?
I think I might have.
Shame.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm sorry.
Well, no, it depends. How could it be the singing album?
Yeah, yeah.
I would have gave it to Al.
That was a comedy record, yeah. Wasn't it?
Then 80, the next one was 88, and that was for best concept music video, which was a category that I think only lasted a few years. But I won that for best concept music video, which I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I got to win the Grammy. Then I won for best comedy album for Poodle Hat in 2003 and for Mandatory Fun a couple years ago.
What year did UHF come out?
89.
Yeah. Okay, so that's after Even Worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was about to say, by this point, were other avenues calling you to do certain things as far as like television?
Or- well, since you brought that up, you know, I had to make a very hard call talking about UHF. The summer of 1988 is when we were scheduled to shoot my movie UHF, and that was also when Michael Jackson wanted me to open for him on his European tour.
Wait, what?
Wow.
What?
Yeah, we got. I got
so
the offer.
He was really a fan of yours.
Yeah, yeah, he liked it. He liked the whole thing.
I mean, past like, I'm really flattered about my music. I mean, like, did he buy your records and did he lap
well,
it? Like,
he tells me he used to show UHF at the Neverland Ranch to his guests.
What?
He told me. Well, when we did the Fat video, that was actually Michael Jackson's set. He actually let us use his set to shoot that video.
Oh, I thought you went to Hoyt and Skimmerhorn in Brooklyn. To- Oh,
no,
shit.
That's because it was great because that set was built in Culver City and it was for the kids. Remember, he did like the Baby Bad when he did the Moonwalk
right,
video.
Yeah, yeah.
So the set was like at 9/10 scale to make the kids look a little bigger. But it also was great for the Fat video because it made the Fat
make
people
you
even,
look-
yeah, even bigger.
So both of y'all shared that set?
Yep. Yep.
Wait a minute.
Because we knew the set was still there and they're about to tear it down. And we're like, no, don't tear it down. We want to use it. And they're like, okay, cool.
Wait, Fonte. Old boy from House Party. Make me some Dick Gregory.
Ludie Washington.
Ludie Washington.
How do you know that?
Yeah, Ludie Washington. I knew that too.
Yeah.
Ding dong, man. Ding dong.
Yeah.
Ding dong.
Yeah, ding dong.
Ludie was great. He was also in UHF in the movie. He played the cameraman in that.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So funny.
Yeah.
Ludie Washington?
Yeah.
You don't remember him from like the Robert Townsend special?
Well, he was in a lot of them.
Yeah, but I didn't. You guys, you two are the we read credits and
we read the liner notes,
that sort of thing. Were you hesitant to revisit Michael Jackson a second time around, or was it just too irresistible?
A little bit. I mean, it was sort of low hanging fruit, but at the same time, it's sort of like Michael Jackson was so, you know, omnipresent in the 80s. It was sort of like, you know, how could you not do Michael? If I didn't do, you know, a parody on Bad, people were like, how come we're not doing a parody on Bad? Yeah. It's sort of like, and that was one of those cases where, you know, like I said, usually I think of like 100 different variations on a theme and I like analyze it to death. But I remember the first time I saw the Bad video, saw the world premiere, and before the video was even over, I said, I'm doing Fat. It's got to be Fat. We're going to have these like huge
Were you
people.
Already writing
yeah,
the...
I was like, I was like, we're going to have these huge people trying to get through a turnstile and they can't quite get through. It's going to be great.
You ain't nothing.
You must have been
you
watching...
Ain't fat, you ain't nothing.
You must have been watching world premiere videos back then.
Oh, yeah,
just,
absolutely.
Just like drooling like...
You had to stay on top of the zeitgeist.
Yeah,
so as far as turnaround is concerned... Like, it's a shame that the internet wasn't around back in the 80s for you to turn things over in record time. So, for you, was there sort of an expiration date on ideas? Like, I have to have this out within the next 4 months or...
Yeah, I mean, because it's like a two-month turnaround between, like, having... The master done and having a record in stores, and they sometimes they can, if they really want to, they can bump it a couple of weeks, but it's still like certainly more than a month, and that's if you have an album done. Like if I wanted to do a parody and the album's like not even close to being finished, it's like, well, this isn't going to come out for several months, which is why I generally, you know, the way I usually do it is I record an entire album except for one track and I wait for what I perceive to be like, yeah, the big one. Like, here's the big single, here's the big video, and the rest of the album is just sort of like in the can, waiting to go.
Oh, so all the other non-parody ideas get...
Right. And hopefully those are all songs that, you know, people will still remember and they'll still be funny, but back then, the things have changed nowadays, but back then it really was all about, here's a single driving the album, because, you know, regardless of whether radio got behind it, MTV would play it, and, you know, if you had a big hit on MTV, you had a big hit album.
What, in your concert, what is your unlikely, how can I say this? You're free bird. Like, what's the non-single? There was one song that we actually did on the show that I was shocked that Jimmy, because I wanted to do Hooked on Polka.
Uh-huh.
But then thankfully I realized that song was way too complex for us to even conquer it. But I forgot it's a slow song that's on either someone drowns. Now I got to look it up. But
it's a ballad.
Yeah, it's a ballad.
Is it You Don't Love Me Anymore? No.
No.
Was it?
Hang on.
Clue. Weird Al trivia.
It's hang on. It's definitely on Dare to Be Stupid.
Okay. Slow song.
But it has a sort of twisted. Not.
Is it a parody?
No. It isn't. It's. Oh God, I hate this moment. I'm having a brain fart because we rehearsed it in the. We did it as an internet extra song.
Oh, you mean Good Old Days?
Yes.
Oh, that was off of Even Worse.
Okay. Yeah. Good old. Like, what is your Freebird when people are yelling? Like, what's a fan favorite?
There's not just like one song. I mean, there's not like one song everybody's into. There's like a half a dozen parodies that are sort of like the big hits that people basically come to expect. In terms of original songs, I think probably the biggest fan favorite is Dare to Be Stupid. And that's maybe partly because it was used in the original Transformers movie and people have affection
yeah,
for
memories,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dare to Be Stupid. Yeah, I remember. So for you, I guess I want to get to the Coolio's scenario. I was going to say, besides Coolio, was there anyone that had indifference to a cover that they previously approved but then they didn't like? Or
not really. I mean, I've never, after somebody who's approved the parody, I've never heard back afterwards that they were disappointed. I heard on Behind the Music, I think Flea was like, not that thrilled with the Red Hot Chili Peppers parody. I was like, yeah, it was okay.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Wait, which song?
He gave it away.
And it was about the Flintstones?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. He didn't dislike it. It was just, it's sort of like a meh.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, once you're covered, then you're, you know.
You're immortalized.
So. You're super immortalized. So for you, what is, what's the daily preparation of your band and your tour and that sort of thing? Like,
gosh, well, there's no, like, you know, typical day. You know, my life at home and my life on the road are completely different realities. And when I'm on tour, I basically try not to use my voice if I can help it, because I've gotten laryngitis and totally lost my voice on tour before. And that's not pleasant, because if you lose your voice, I mean, really the only cure is not talking for a week. Yeah. And you can't do that if you have to do a, you know, 2-hour show every night. So I'm very careful, you know, stay out of air conditioning, stay out of smoky rooms. I just try to use my voice as infrequently as possible. So basically after the show, go back to the bus, you know, probably surf the internet for a few hours. And then when I wake up, we're already traveling to the next city. And I just, you know, try not to talk until sound check.
So do you turn off the air conditioning on stage?
No.
No. That's some Aretha Franklin.
Some people do. Well, I don't want to make the whole world uncomfortable. I just, you know, just the back of the bus.
Oh, okay. I see. It's, as far as your, the ritual of, I'm having a brain fart moment right now.
Can you make that fart sound with your No,
the as far as your sets are concerned, and because I know now it's, you do these elaborate changes and all those things, like how full scale are your concert performances?
Well, they have been very full scale. I mean, I'd love to get you out to a show sometime, but it was, you know, it becomes sort of like almost like a Broadway show in that there's costumes and props, and everything is timed out to the second. Like, you know, I do a big song with full costumes, and then we play a video on a big screen on stage, which is just long enough for us to run backstage and do a costume change and come back out for the next song. So it's as much spectacle and theater as we could put into a live show. Having said that, the next tour, which is starting in end of February, we're not doing any of that. For the first time in, you know, ever, we're going out and just playing songs, no costumes, no props, and we're playing the deep cuts. We're playing, not playing the hits. We're playing like,
say what?
Yeah, totally. It's called the ridiculously. I'm gonna mess it up. The ridiculously self-indulgent, ill-advised vanity tour. and we're not playing the hits. We're playing all the obscure, you know, deep cuts and B-sides and stuff that you'd never expect us to play live. So, and we're doing a different show every single night, which is fun for us because when we do the normal show, it has to, by definition, it has to be the same exact show because it's all calculated. But the next tour is going to be wildly different from night to night.
So when you're saying no hits, so you won't be doing Teen Spirit or Eat It, or do you still do Eat It in concert?
Yeah, not the whole song, but part of a medley, yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's just strictly the non-parody things, or?
Yeah, we might throw in a couple surprises, but you should definitely not come to the tour expecting to hear the hits, because it's really all about the stuff that nobody wants to hear. I want to do an audience-displeasing show.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I'm not saying Costello did that, but he did you ever see
the Wheel
tour?
Yeah, that was very cool.
Yeah.
My friend just told me to do a cover of Radio Radio.
You know, we do that whenever something screws up, which didn't happen hardly at all in the last tour, but there were some tours where we were having problems with a computer server, and the computer server, you know, it does the video and it does whatever click tracks we're using, and it's an integral part of the show. Mm. And if there's a hiccup or if something goes wrong, you know, it's a train wreck. And sometimes when that happens, instead of just, you know, standing on stage stupidly, we go into Radio Radio, like, ladies and gentlemen, there's no reason to play this song. Radio!
I get it.
The SNL.
You don't change the words to computer.
No, just a straight version.
Okay.
How extensive will the tour be?
We're doing like 75, 76 dates. The show, Emo Phillips is opening for us, which will be fun.
No!
Wow.
I love Emo.
Really? So
he's doing half an hour. My band is doing like 90 minutes. And it's going to be a lot. I'm really looking forward to it. And I'll get to it. We want a really intimate vibe. It's going to be, I want it to be kind of like a hanging out in your living room vibe. You know, like everybody in the audience, just sort of in your living room, and we're just kind of being very, you know, casual and, you know, spontaneous. Because my shows are not normally spontaneous. I don't normally like chat with the audience, and so I just want this one to. I'm a little outside of my comfort zone because I like knowing in advance what I'm going to say, but I'm trying to break out of that and just, you know, just trying to hang.
You're trying to challenge yourself
a little bit.
It's admirable. Your tours, is it just national for the United States, or
it's a world tour playing Canada too?
have you ever done other, like, how do you fare in other countries?
Canada very well.
All right, Saskatchewan.
Australia is a good market for us. We played there 3 or 4 times, and pockets of Europe. We did a couple small European tours, and I definitely have some fans over there. But North America is really the main market.
When was the moment that you knew, since you dive into so many genres, like at this point you're a treasure to all kinds of communities, all kinds of music. Was there a moment when you knew it and you felt it, like, oh, I'm not like the other kids. I can do this. I can do that. I can go here.
Like before my career?
During your career. Yeah, because from hip hop to country to polka to pop to rock to grunge.
Yeah.
And nobody says, no, you don't belong here. Everybody is like, he's ours.
It's hard to say. I mean, I first kind of felt the fame during the, you know, the N3D and Eat It days. But I don't think I really kind of felt like the mass acceptance until about 10 years ago. Because people kept waiting for me to go away. Like, oh, Weird Al's still hanging around. What's he doing here? Like, you know, because everybody thought, you know, that I was just some kind of phase that, you know, people are going to get tired of. And some people did. But I mean, in general, I was able to maintain some semblance of a career since the early 80s. And it wasn't until about 10 years ago, people were like, oh, I grew up with Weird Al. Like, really? Okay.
Nah, seriously. No, yeah. Nah, this is like a direct, you're a direct link to my childhood. Like, straight up. Like,
well,
just
you,
everything. When you did the Amish Paradise, first off, where did that idea come from?
Well, it's funny. I was trying to think of an idea for Gangsta's Paradise, and as soon as the thought Amish Paradise came into my mind, I thought the idea was so good it made me depressed. I thought it was perfect because, like, the Amish lifestyle is diametrically opposed to the gangster lifestyle. So to see Amish people acting like gangsters, I thought was just hilarious. And I thought, I can definitely do this. And it made me depressed because as soon as I thought of that, I thought, okay, the machine is gonna, you know, snap into action now. Now I have to write it. Now I have to like book video time. We have to like figure out the release date. And I just saw my whole like next 6 months ahead of me. Like, okay, we're doing this. Come on.
Whose idea was it? I don't know who directed it. The scene where all the sweat is pouring off your head.
I directed the video.
Oh my god! Yeah, man. That shit was because that was something that I always noticed in the original. With the singer LV where he was sweating.
Yeah,
and then the scene. I was like, yo, he caught it too. I was like, he was hot as hell singing that damn song.
It's air conditioning.
And Florence Henderson.
Yes.
Yes. Was she like your first? Just what was the approach to her, and how did you get her to?
In all truth, we did ask Michelle Pfeiffer first because she was in the original. And then I obviously Florence Henderson gets all the work that Michelle Pfeiffer turns down. So we went to her second, and she was amazing. She was like, you know, she really was into it. She was like sucking in her cheeks like Michelle, just really, really going for it.
What was the issue, or what was Coolio's problem with the song, and how did that even get to be a thing? Because did you have to approve it from him first, or did you have to approach him first to parody the song?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I always get permission, and unfortunately, I'll never to this day know really what happened, because it's very he said, she said kind of thing. My record label at the time told me that they talked to Coolio and that he okayed it. And then after the fact, you know, Coolio made a public statement saying that he never approved it and that he was essentially offended by it. And it was horrible because, you know, I like my track record of not upsetting anybody and having good relationships. So that was, and Coolio's fine now, by the way, but there were a number of years that there was, you know, I don't want to say bad blood, but I kind of kept my distance.
So Coolio felt some type of way, but T.I., he was cool.
Yeah, no, he was great.
Yeah, tell me about the T.I. pitch, and I mean, I'm sure he was over the roof because he probably is like us. He was a child and fan of yours.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I don't have a really personal story about that. Okay. That was one of those kind of things where like I told my manager what I wanted to do, and he contacted T.I.'s people, and it came back that he was cool with it.
Damn, I wonder what your percentage rate is of that. Like, that's crazy.
I will say that was part of my pitch to
Chameleonaire?
No. Fancy.
You're so fancy.
Fergie. What's her
name? No, it's not Fergie. I can't remember.
I can't believe I'm blanking.
Oh, yeah. The girl with the booty.
Azalea.
Yeah. No, not her.
Ziggy.
I'm so
Ziggy,
sorry.
Iggy Azalea.
I'm so sorry.
Damn, yo, it's so, so in the sorry. Past we forgot.
Wait,
her.
I didn't see that one.
But that was one where I couldn't get permission through their management. We weren't getting through, and I was like one song away from finishing Mandatory Fun, and I wanted to do my parody of Fantasy, because Fantasy was sort of like the song of the summer. I was like, I just, you know, we have a release date. I want to record this, but we don't have permission, and nobody was getting through. And finally, I basically had a stalker. I said, oh, she's doing a concert in Denver, Colorado. I was like, I'm flying there. And I flew to Denver, and I hung out backstage, and literally as she was walking off stage, I said, Iggy, hey, it's Weird Al. I really love to do a parody of your song.
Did she know who you were?
I think so. I think it's hard to say, but I think so. And she said, well,
she's just so aloof to me that I wouldn't imagine that.
I wouldn't give a damn.
But she said, you know, I'd have to see the lyrics first. And said, well, I actually happen to have them in my pocket. And I put them in front of her. And while she was reading it, I said, you know, T.I. was cool with it. That was because, you know.
Yeah, right? That's your boss.
Ooh,
see?
Your boss man was cool with it.
Is that the most extreme that you had to travel to get?
It might be. I mean, yeah, I don't think I've ever gotten on a plane to get permission from somebody before.
But wait, Al, because as I'm looking at this video for Tacky, I'm like, so Aisha and the other people that you had, my man from Modern Family and
Eric Stonestreet, and Jack Black and Kristen Schaal and Margaret Cho.
When you asked them, I'm sure they were like, hell fucking yeah. I mean, see, hell freaking yeah. I'm sorry. But right, like, tell me, what was their reaction?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of went through my address book and I picked some of my friends and everybody that was available on that day were happy to do it. That was the most fun I've ever had doing a video. It was just such a blast. I mean, we got done so quickly, I was almost sad. I was like, I wish we could do this all night long. This is so fun.
Yeah, damn, that's dope.
How did you approach doing the R. Kelly trapped in the... man, because that was one of the moments, I'll say, like, you've been... Because I'm a person, I do a lot of work, like, in TV, and I do, like, musical parodies and stuff for a show, whatever. And the thing that I think listening to your music has taught me is that in order for something to be funny, it has to be good. Like, so if you're going to parody something, you've got to really be singing it. Like, you really got to treat it like a real song.
Sure.
Yeah, it's got to be believable. And the thing with all your stuff is that it always, it's funny, but if you just listen to that song, it's like, yo, this motherfucker's really singing. Like, even, like, the harmonies from the joint we listened to the other night.
The Johnny.
Yeah, the Johnny. It was like, yo, he really singing this shit. Mm-hmm. So when I heard the Trapped in the Closet, it was Trapped in the Closet.
Trapped in the Drive-Thru.
Trapped in the Drive-Thru. That was Trapped. Trapped in the Closet is a song that is probably a parody in itself. So for you to do it, like, what led to that?
Well, yeah, that was a tough one to do because that was one of those things. Trapped in the Closet was just such a monumental composition. It was sort of like, you know, it was such a thing that, again, it was sort of like, you know, if Weird Al doesn't do anything with this, like, what's he thinking? But it, at the same time, it was so weird anyway. Like, where do you go with it? You can't really make it more bizarre or more ridiculous. Yeah. So I thought, well, you know, the humor of opposites, I'll just make it as boring and banal and monotonous and mundane as I possibly can, and just make it about 11 minutes about like a couple discussing what they want to do for dinner, you know, and but still keeping all the high drama of the original, but making about it as something ridiculously stupid.
Man, nah, you definitely nailed it. That shit was hilarious.
Thank you, man.
I haven't quite figured out how this idea would work, but have you ever considered doing a duets album?
I was going to ask, have you ever did any collaborations?
Not as such. I mean, that my first single was sort of a duet with because I did a song called Ricky, which was me being Ricky Ricardo.
I thought you were
Ricky,
Lucy.
No.
That was Tress McNeil, who now is like one of the most famous voiceover artists in the world. I mean, she's on Animaniacs, she's on Simpsons. I mean, she's like one of the top people. Wow. But at the time, she was new in LA. I mean, brand new. And we put out an ad in some music paper saying we were looking for somebody to impersonate Lucille Ball, to somebody to sing like Lucille Ball. And we got literally two responses, and one of them was Tress.
Damn.
We're like getting backstage paper. And
yeah, it was one of those kind of things. And she came in. She was great. And she played Lucy in the video as well. That's the same person that does it on the record. And unfortunately, she couldn't tour with us. So whenever, you know, it was kind of weird because during that first tour, our big single, we couldn't do live. So we basically just played the video. I think back then it was like on a 16mm projector. Like, and here's our video, you know.
Really?
Because we couldn't, you know.
Costume
change. We couldn't
have
my drummer like, oh, Ricky, you know, we couldn't have him trying to do Tress's part.
That's the costume change time.
Yeah.
Said Terry Bozzio did it with Frank Zappa. Anything could happen.
You ever think of doing other, not that I would assume to have known that you haven't, but other genres? Is there any other genres that you would like to dip into? Like, is there a reggae weird?
There is. I mean, I've covered most of the, I'm sure there's some I haven't yet, but yeah, I did a reggae song called Buy Me a Condo. It's sort of like a Bob Marley-ish kind of vibe. like a Jamaican yuppie song.
And some of the new genres.
Like, I was about to say, have you wrapped your head around trap music yet? And mumble culture.
So some genres are a little bit harder to parody because there's not enough
words,
raw material. Yeah, like EDM would be fun to do, but you know, you can't. It would be too repetitive.
Or maybe you could just do polka covers of them.
That's true. Songs. Which is what I do. Like, you know,
yeah, a polka Despacito.
You know, like
yes,
Despacito.
Yes,
yeah.
Oh, I would like just future
on an accordion. And like no payoff when you get to the top.
No drops. Right. Dale.
I would love that. Have you have there been any pitches for you to do like kids shows or children's shows?
Man, yeah, well, really. Well,
I did a children's show in the late 90s called The Weird Al Show on CBS.
Right.
It was like 97, 98, something like that. But yeah, it was on one season, 13 shows.
I was also 26 years old.
Yeah.
The Weird Al Show. Hold on.
You weren't the core.
You're glad that, yeah.
No, I'm trying
I'll tell
to
you what TV show I would like to see back come back, and that's Al TV.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I used to love those Al TV
when did
specials.
That come on?
Used to be like almost one, like whenever you would put out a new album.
Yeah, well, it wasn't some people, I used to watch your old series. Like, it wasn't a series or like a special that I would do every year, whenever I had an album to promote, really.
Mm-hmm.
MTV would play them a lot.
Yeah, those were brilliant. The interviews, the fake interviews, yeah. I used to love those.
Yeah, take
love
people's interviews out of context and play all sorts of random weird videos. I mean, that was back in the day, you know, when MTV would, well, first of all, they'd play videos.
Do your hair on like this.
Yeah.
I forgot he interviewed Prince where, you know, Prince did something like
his
arm.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, could you do your arm like this?
Yeah. Prince, what do you think about this beach ball?
It's multicolored and it's very fun.
Yeah, you know, it's just random stuff like that. You know? But yeah, I mean, that was in the days when MTV kind of, you know, was freeform. They're very guerrilla. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, they didn't care. They're like, you've got this 4 hours. Right. Just do whatever you want.
Right.
I did whatever I wanted for 4 hours.
And I would watch all 4 hours. Yeah.
they gave me no money, but they said, do whatever you want. And kind of went nuts. It was great.
Yeah. I, like I said, I love those specials.
Thank you, man.
How come you didn't pursue more movies after UHF?
I would have liked to have done more movies, but the crushing failure of my first movie kind of dampened everybody's
opinion. But it's almost
a cult classic.
Why do you think it failed? I mean, it was funny. I mean, why do you think it didn't go?
It's hard to say. I mean, critics, you know, generally hated it. Siskel and Ebert thought I was the Antichrist, I think. And it came out, you know, this is sort of an excuse, but it's also true. It came out in the middle of one of the biggest blockbuster summers ever. So it came out while, you know, Batman and Lethal Weapon and Honey, I Shrunk the Kids and Do the Right Thing. And, you know, a bunch of stuff was out at the same time. So it would have done a lot better if it had come out during a slower time of the year. But, you know, there's no telling. I mean, I'm just very happy that, you know, it's found its audience and now it's at least got cult status.
No, it definitely has that.
When was Alapalooza?
Oh, 1993.
I have an autographed copy of that CD somehow.
Oh, cool.
Somehow.
So do you often meet, the way that like cats come up to me like, yo, man, can I spit a few bars for you? You know, like people are always trying to. I'm certain that every night there's someone that when you're doing in-stores and autographs and of the like, that someone saying like, hey, I'm the new you or that sort of thing. Like
they always try to give me ideas like, you know what you should do? And it's always some awful parody idea that they thought of in the third grade, but they were just waiting for their chance to meet me, you know, tell them this great idea.
How do you
of a Duran Duran parody from the 80s that, oh, that'll seem great.
How do you laugh them off? Like, oh, yeah.
The stock answer is, I'll get right to work on that.
Or, no, you know, they won't hear that. No. I mean, but people that meet you and say that, you know, I too want to be in the same. Because the thing is like, there's one Weird Al, and you've literally shut it down for anyone trying to come. I mean, there's some like morning shows that do, you know, things on radio, but
the thing is nowadays there's YouTube. There's avenues for people to get their stuff out there. When I started, it was sort of a mystery. Like, how do you penetrate this black box of, you know, of MTV? And it was, you know, a little bit harder to navigate.
But even it seems like with your last album, you have like high humor and your level of humor and your pen game is past just, you know, twisting a noun and a verb around. Yeah. So it's like, have you thought about like, is there anyone out there like that you would like to produce that's the next Weird Hour?
Oh gosh, the next, you know, coming up. I mean, there's a lot of people that do funny music. I love Lonely Island, Tenacious D, Flight of the Conchords.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of people doing great, great comedy stuff. As far as coming up, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of funny people on YouTube. Randy Rainbow is really funny. You know, I don't know about producing other acts. I mean, I'd entertain that idea, I guess. But I don't know. We'll see on that one.
Amir, can you tell the story, or one of you tell the story about the Dilla sample with the?
Oh, no. With no, it's the,
yeah.
You're thinking of accordion.
Yeah, exactly. I don't even know what I'm asking. But
I want Mad Villainy joint.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. One of my favorite moments with you ever was you. It actually made Pitchfork, which is weird. It was like the nicest thing Pitchfork said about me in 2013. No, you playing
accordion,
Mad Libs accordion.
Yeah.
Which, you know. That was
brilliant idea.
No, but you're not telling the, like, for the listeners like me who don't really know.
Yeah, I don't know what y'all talking about.
But it wasn't No. It wasn't a Weird Al song. It's just that when Weird Al came on the Tonight Show,
right?
We didn't cover.
And he had his accordion.
Yeah,
right.
I was like, yo, we have to do MF. What was the project?
Mad Villain.
Mad Villain.
The Mad Villain cover of accordion, which is basically a song that's looped over an accordion. Actually, what I found that loop.
Yeah, it's Daedalus.
It
oh,
is.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's...
You know what they're talking about, Al?
I do, okay. Absolutely. Yeah, we did. Because
he was there with me.
We kind of jammed on that for a while. I got to tell you, man, that some of my favorite times of my life were just hanging backstage with the Roots and playing with you guys.
Didn't I see you one year at like a Roots jam? Like when the Grammy thing? I swear I saw him one year in L.A. at a Roots jam.
You came inside of a Roots jam?
Every year, motherfucker.
No, I'm not. You?
Oh, Al. Oh, Al, yes.
Is it wrong for me to play it in front of Weird Al?
Hell no.
Cover your ears.
I ain't mean it that time.
So I have a question. So did you end up doing 10 records for Scotty Brothers or what actually happened to Scotty Brothers?
I feel like they're tied up in a river. Like
Scotty Brothers also owned I think All American Broadcasting, which owned Baywatch. So they're sitting on a pile of money somewhere.
Oh, good.
They're
good for Scotty Brothers.
I don't think they're a record label anymore. But I was sold as an asset, you know, because they still owned however many albums on my contract. And I got sold to somebody else. And then I got sold to somebody else. And I renegotiated the contract twice. And each time I renegotiated, they tacked on a couple more albums. So basically, it became a 14-album contract.
Wow.
And my last album, Mandatory Fun, was album number 14. So
in just
32,
do you get to own your masters or
no? But in just 32 short years, I was able to fulfill my contractual obligation.
So you're still quote on the label?
No. I fulfilled it when I delivered the last album, and that was it. They wanted to re-sign me, which was very nice, and they made a very generous offer. But after being under contract for so long, I just really kind of wanted to be a free agent, not beholden to anybody. I hate the idea of just owing people stuff. I just don't want to have that kind of pressure hanging over me.
Do you know who Richard Cheese is?
Sure.
Yes.
Mark Davis.
Have you? I'm starting to figure out like who's the closest person that could that has a following.
Yeah.
That
Mark does sort of like with lounge music what I do with polka music. He does like the hits of the day, like in his kind of like schmaltzy Vegas lounge style.
But is he latter day Tupac to your latter day Biggie? Like, y'all don't mess with each other.
He's an old friend.
I went to school with Suge Knight.
Yeah.
So wow. What other labels did you end up being on after Scotty?
Gosh,
BMG or something?
Yeah, BMG and some version of CBS and Epic and RCA and Volcano Records and even one of the weird sounding labels. Yeah, even when it was on the same label, sometimes they'd change their name or they'd add some subsidiary. And wow. I've probably been on a dozen different label imprints over my career.
How did it feel? Because your last album actually went to number one, correct?
Yeah.
How surreal was that you had the number one pop album?
It blew my mind. It really did, because it was basically unprecedented. Never before had a comedy album debuted at number one.
Mandatory Fun, right?
Yeah, Mandatory Fun. And the last time a comedy album even reached number one was in 1963.
Bob Newhart, right?
That was Alan Sherman. But back in the early 60s, comedy albums go to number one all the time. Alan Sherman had 3 number one albums, and Bob Newhart won like the album of the year at the Grammys, I believe. It was like, back then, like comedy was, viewed as more important. But yeah, there hadn't been a number one album since then. And I just kind of thought that was, there was a glass ceiling or whatever. It just was like not within the realm of possibility. I thought, I really hope that my last album cracks the top 10, because that would be cool for me to kind of go out in a big way. And then when I found out that, I had a good chance of hitting number one, it was very surrealistic for me, because, I'm obsessed with the Billboard charts. And I've been studying them for decades. Mm-hmm. And to think that I would have a number one album was just beyond my comprehension.
That's weird. So you'd have to do a parody of one of your songs.
That's right.
That's impossible. The world would
explode. The Weird Al Inception.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Well, Al, thank you for doing this for us.
It was such a pleasure, man. Thank you.
We're such fans of yours.
Yes. Congratulations.
Thank you.
On the tour, on your star on the Walk of Fame.
Oh,
right?
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So all those things. Yes.
I also have to come back to my roll call. I wasn't lying when I said that was one of the top 10 shows I've ever seen in my entire life.
How old were you when you seen it?
I was in my 20s. I was in college at the time, and it was like maybe 99, 2000 or something like that. And
Running with Scissors tour, maybe.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah. And like, I considered myself a fan, but I didn't really realize how many of your songs I knew until I saw you perform them all back to back to back to
no,
back.
No, even sitting here just talking about it, I was like, damn, he did do that one.
Yeah,
he did do
that one. That's pretty much how it was. It's like, yeah, it's like, oh man, I forgot about that one.
And I forgot about
and
Ricky.
Then I started realizing, yeah, I remember the lyrics too. And so I'm just like, I'm a bigger Weird Al fan than I thought I was, you know? And so, like, after that, I started really going back deeper and deeper into the catalog, and it was just, yeah.
Well, you know, I'm still going through my Weird Al phase.
Damn, now, you know, my first show is going to be the...
You should go. Like, I saw this man was hopping around on one leg with the other leg behind his head during the... Like, what? It was amazing.
Yes.
Can I still do that?
What?
You still got it.
Yo, wow. Wait,
be careful.
Okay.
Yo, be careful.
Yeah, that is a
wow. Oh, shit.
And it is done.
Wow.
Damn. Yeah.
And I'm an old man.
Contortionist.
Wow, yeah, man.
That must be that vegetarian.
Is that yoga? Is
one
it
of
yoga?
The most
right,
entertaining
yoga?
Shows.
Yeah.
One of the most entertaining shows ever.
I had all my bones removed, so I'm, you know.
Wow.
But yeah, one of the most entertaining shows I've ever seen in my entire life.
Wow. That's amazing. Anyway.
That's nuts.
How do you describe that? What we just seen on the radio?
So he took his leg.
We got photo. We'll post it up on Instagram.
Contortionist Al Yankovic.
Yeah.
So on behalf of Sugar Steve and Boss Bill and Fonticolo and It's Like Ia, Al, we thank you very much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank
you. I can't wait to finally see you in concert. The deep cuts. Maybe we'll just do one of the hits for the encore, just for me. This is Questlove of the Questlove Supreme, and we will see you on the next go round. Thank you.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.